gentlemen, will you please stand?
Your Excellency, it is my very great pleasure to welcome you to the University of Cambridge at the beginning of our 800th anniversary year. We are most grateful that you have agreed to deliver a lecture in the oldest and most distinguished named series of lectures at the university, the Reed Lectures, established in the 16th century. I would like to say a little about the almost 500-year history of these lectures. As early as the 15th century, lectures had been given in Cambridge by ordinary lecturers in the humanities, in logic, and in natural or moral philosophy. But funding for the lecturers was not secure. In 1524, however, the university benefited from an early act of philanthropy. The executors of the will of Sir Robert Reed, Chief Justice of England under King Henry VII and King Henry VIII, arranged to provide an endowment to pay the lecturers. By the mid-19th century, the series had been splendidly reconstituted as a single annual distinguished lecture. It is wonderful indeed to continue the great tradition of Reed Lectures in our 800th year with your visit and your presentation, Premier. The Cambridge community is eager to hear you. Last Wednesday, when you spoke at the World Economic Forum in Davos, it was to a packed auditorium, standing room only. For your lecture today, Your Excellency, nearly 2,000 of our students and staff applied for tickets. We appreciate your readiness to engage in an open dialogue with your audiences about China's policies and prospects, last week in Davos, and today with our students, tomorrow's leaders. The free exchange of views and opinions is vital in a context of change and global interdependency. But opinion alone is little without mutual understanding. Universities have played a part in creating that understanding for 1,000 years. And in Cambridge, we have played our own part for 8 centuries. In 1954, Cambridge University Press published the first volume in a series entitled Science and Civilization in China. Its author was Dr. Joseph Needham of Gonville and Caius College. Needham initially imagined that one volume would be enough, but the Needham Research Institute continues his work even to this day, and although 23 parts of the series have been published, there is still a way to go. That Cambridge publication in 1954 was a landmark in serious study of China, its history, and its capabilities by the West. But the history of understanding between East and West owes at least as much to the efforts from the East. In December 1978, at the third plenum of the 11th Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, a program of economic reforms was launched, and with it, an opening up of markets and of minds. Successive Chinese leaders have shaped that trajectory, but have not turned it back. The consequences of China's development have been without precedent, and the opportunities for partnership and collaboration grow exponentially. The academic staff of our faculties and departments are engaged in more than 130 collaborations with Chinese universities, academies, and institutions. When I was in Beijing in October, I added to the list by signing a memorandum of understanding with the Chinese Academy of Sciences and another with the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. These formalize existing links and are also a declaration of our intent to work together on the common challenges that face the world: climate change, good governance, renewable energy, stable financial systems, infectious and degenerative disease. But perhaps the strongest ties which bind Cambridge and China are our students. There are 719 Chinese students in Cambridge today, many supported by Chinese scholarships. Among the 719 is our most senior student, Jin Young, Louis Cha here, who is pursuing a PhD at 84 years of age. Cambridge will never stop teaching and learning about China. This lecture is a further landmark in that increased understanding. I am very pleased that Premier Wen has agreed to take questions after his lecture. That is an exceptional opportunity, and I know that a Cambridge audience will have serious questions to ask. Questions will be moderated by Sir Christopher Hum, who is doubly qualified for the task. Firstly, because he was British ambassador to China until 2006, and secondly, because he is currently Master of Gonville and Caius College, and in that capacity counts Joseph Needham among his predecessors. Thank you. Thank you.
Vice Chancellor Alison Richard,
同学们,
faculty members, students,
今天外边下着大雪,
it's snowing heavily outside,
天气严寒,
and it's really cold today.
但是我的心是热的,
but I've got a warm heart here and I feel warm.
我早已盼望在剑桥,
I've long wanted to come to Cambridge University and to meet you and to exchange views with you. Now we are in this bleak winter of financial crisis. But when I see young people, I feel as I see the coming of spring, I see brightness and future, because I firmly believe the power of knowledge and the courage of young people will change the destiny of mankind, the destiny of the country and the whole world. A good speech should not have too much modification, and a speaker should speak with his heart and speak honestly and frankly. That's the very nature of making speech.
同学们
I hope
思想以启迪
What I will say today will offer a little inspiration to you. I hope you will remember one or two sentences that I will say. If that's true, I will feel satisfied.
到高等学府，我的心里总是充满着一种。
Actually, when I'm in universities or colleges, I always have admiration and respect.
是由于我对知识。
That's because I admire and respect universities, colleges, faculty members, and students. That's why I bowed deeply just now for all the students and teachers here. That's not only for the sake of courtesy.That's the way a student treats Vice Chancellor and fellow students. Cambridge University is a world-renowned university. It has produced many great scientists and thinkers, Isaac Newton, Charles Darwin, and Francis Bacon, to name but a few, and made important contribution to the progress of human civilization. This year marks the 800th anniversary of the university.Please accept my warm congratulations. Before I start my speech, I would like to present to you a China Digital Library, a collection of over 200,000 e-books published in China, which cover China's political and economic life, history and culture. I hope it will help you learn more about China. This is my fourth visit to your country. Despite the great distance between China and Britain, the friendly exchanges between our peoples have been on the rise. The successful resolution of the question of Hong Kong and fruitful cooperation between our two countries in areas such as economy, trade, culture, education, science and technology have cemented the foundation of our comprehensive strategic partnership. Here, I wish to pay high tribute to all those who have been working tirelessly to promote friendly ties between our two countries. The title of my speech today is See China in the Light of Her Development. My beloved motherland is a country both old and young.She is old because she is a big oriental country with a civilization stretching back several thousand years. With diligence and wisdom, the Chinese nation created a splendid civilization and made significant contributions to the progress of humanity. She is young because the People's Republic is just 60 years old, and the country began reform and opening up only 30 years ago. The Chinese people established the new China after unremitting struggles and ultimately found a development path suited to China's national conditions through painstaking efforts. This is the path of socialism with Chinese characteristics. Following this path, our ancient civilization has been rejuvenated. The key element of China's reform and opening up is to free people's mind. And the most fundamental and significant component is institutional innovation. Through economic restructuring, we have built a socialist market economy where the market plays a primary role in allocating resources under government macro regulation. We have carried out political restructuring, promoted democracy, and improved the legal system. People are the masters of the country. We run the country according to law and endeavor to build a socialist country under the rule of law. The essence of China's reform and opening up is to put people first and meet their ever-growing material and cultural needs through releasing and developing productive forces. It aims to give everyone equal opportunities for all-round development. It aims to protect the democratic rights of the people and promote stability, harmony, and prosperity across the land. And it aims to safeguard the dignity and freedom of everyone so that he or she may pursue happiness with ingenuity and hard work.
30年来,
over the past three decades, more than 200 million Chinese have been lifted out of poverty. The average life expectancy has increased by 5 years, and the 83 million people with disabilities in China have received special care from the government and the society. All this points to the tremendous efforts China has made to protect human rights. We have introduced free 9-year compulsory education throughout the country, established the cooperative medical system in the rural areas, and improved the social safety net. The age-old dream of the Chinese nation is being turned into reality, a dream to see the young educated, the sick treated, and the old cared for. I want to quote from a Tang Dynasty poem to describe what is happening in China. From shore to shore, it is white at high tide, and before fair wind, a sail is lifting. The Chinese people are working hard to modernize their country. This is a great experiment in a large developing country, both ancient and new. The Chinese people, with destiny in their own hands, are full of confidence in their future. My beloved motherland is a country that stood numerous vicissitudes but never gave up. Earlier in my career, I worked in Northwest China for many years. There, in the boundless desert, grows a rare variety of tree called Euphrates poplar, rooted over 50 meters down the ground. They thrive in hostile environments, defying droughts, sandstorms, and salinization. They are known as the hero tree because a Euphrates poplar can live for 1,000 years. Even after it dies, it stands upright for 1,000 years. And even after it falls, it stays intact for 1,000 years. I like Euphrates poplar because they symbolize the resilience of the Chinese nation. Over the millennia, the Chinese nation has weathered numerous disasters, both natural and man-made, surmounted all kinds of difficulties and challenges, and made her way to where she proudly stands today. The long sufferings have only made her a nation of fortitude and perseverance. The experience of the Chinese nation attests to a truth. What a nation loses in times of disaster will be made up for by her progress. I am reminded of the experience that I had in Wenchuan, Sichuan province, after the devastating earthquake there last May. On the traditional Chinese New Year Eve, I went to the disaster hit area and I spent the New Year Spring Festival Eve there. The earthquake last May shocked the whole world. It flattened Beichuan Middle School and claimed many young lives. On the site of the rescue, I once commanded and coordinated the rescue efforts. I hugged closely a kid. Not long ago, a student who was studying painting and drawing in Spain painted an oil on canvas about that sight and scene, and the title or the theme of that painting is hugging or embracing. But only 10 days after the earthquake, when I went there for the second time, I had before my eyes new classrooms built on debris by local villagers with planks. Once again, the campus echoed with the sound of students reading aloud. I wrote down four Chinese characters on the blackboard, meaning a country will emerge stronger from adversities. I've been to Wenchuan 7 times since the earthquake and witnessed countless touching scenes like this. I'm deeply moved by the unyielding spirit of my people. This great national spirit is the source of strength which has enabled the Chinese nation to emerge from all the hardships stronger than before. With hard work over the past half century and more, China has achieved great progress. Its total economic output is now one of the largest in the world. However, we remain a developing country, and we are keenly aware of the big gap that we have with the developed countries. There has been no fundamental change in our basic national condition, a big population, weak economic foundation, and uneven development. China's per capita GDP ranks behind 100 countries in the world and is only about 1/18th that of Britain. Those of you who have been to China as tourists must have seen the modern cities, but our rural areas are still quite backward. To basically achieve modernization by the middle of this century, we must accomplish three major tasks. First, achieve industrialization, which Europe has long completed, while keeping abreast of the latest trends of the scientific and technological revolution. Second, promote economic growth while ensuring social equity and justice. And third, pursue sustainable development at home while accepting our share of international responsibilities. The journey ahead will be long and arduous. If China wants to catch up with developed countries, certainly there will be difficulties. But no amount of difficulty will stop the Chinese people from marching forward. Through persistent efforts, we will reach our goal of modernization. My beloved motherland is a country that values her traditions while opening her arms to the outside world. The traditional Chinese culture is rich, extensive, and profound. Harmony, the supreme value cherished in ancient China, lies at the heart of the Chinese culture. The Book of History, an ancient classic in China, for example, advocates amity among people and friendly exchanges among nations. The Chinese cultural tradition values peace as the most precious. This has nurtured the broad mind of the Chinese nation. The Chinese nation is generous and tolerant, just as Mother Earth cares for all living things. She is in constant pursuit of justice, just as the eternal movement of the universe. In the 15th century, the famous Chinese navigator Zheng He led 7 maritime expeditions to the Western Seas and reached over 30 countries. He took with him Chinese tea, silk, and porcelain, and helped local people fight pirates as he sailed along. He was truly a messenger of love and friendship.
说, 国强必霸,
the argument that a big power is bound to seek hegemony does not apply to China. Seeking hegemony goes against China's cultural tradition, as well as the will of the Chinese people. China's development harms no one and threatens no one. We shall be a peace-loving country, a country that is eager to learn from and cooperate with others. We are committed to building a harmonious world. Different countries and nations need to respect, tolerate, and learn from each other's culture. Today, 300 million Chinese are learning English, and over 1 million of our young people are studying abroad. The cultures and arts of various parts of the world are featured daily on China's television, radio, and print media. Had we not learned from others through exchanges and enriched ourselves by drawing on others' experience, we would not have enjoyed today's prosperity and progress. In the 21st century, economic globalization and the information network have linked us all together. Different cultures live together and influence each other. No culture can flourish in isolation. How much a country or nation contributes to the culture of humanity is increasingly determined by her ability to absorb foreign cultures and renew herself. That is why China will remain open and receptive, value her own traditions while drawing on others' successful experience, and achieve economic prosperity and social progress in a civilized and harmonious way.
Ladies and gentlemen, I stress the importance of seeing China in the light of a development because the world is changing and China is changing. China is no longer the closed and backward society it was 100 years ago, or the poor and ossified society 30 years ago. Thanks to reform and opening up, China has taken on a new look. What the Beijing Olympic Games showcased is a colorful China, both ancient and modern. I therefore encourage you to visit China more often and see more places there. This way you will better understand what the Chinese people are thinking and doing and what they are interested in. You will get to know the true China, a country constantly developing and changing. You will also better appreciate how China has been tackling the ongoing financial crisis. This unprecedented financial crisis has inflicted a severe impact on both China and Britain, as well as other European countries. The crisis has not yet hit the bottom, and it is hard to predict what further damage it may cause. To work together and tide over the difficulties has become our top priority. I believe that closer cooperation is needed to meet the global crisis. At the level of cooperation hinges upon the level of mutual trust. The Chinese government maintains that countries should first and foremost run their own affairs well and remain and refrain from shifting troubles onto others. Second, carry out cooperation with full sincerity and avoid pursuing one's own interests at the expense of others. And third, address both the symptoms and the root cause of the problem. A palliative approach will not work. We should not treat only the head when the head aches and the foot when the foot hurts. As I reiterated at the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos, necessary reform of the international monetary and financial systems should be carried out to establish a new international financial order that is fair, equitable, inclusive, and well managed. We should create an institutional environment conducive to global economic growth. I don't want to repeat what I said at Davos. Here, let me talk briefly about how China has been responding to the crisis. The fallout of the financial crisis on China's real economy is becoming more evident. Since the third quarter of last year, our exports have declined sharply, economic growth has slowed down, and the pressure on employment has been rising. In the face of the grim situation, we have acted decisively. We have made timely adjustment to the direction of our macroeconomic policy, promptly introduced 10 measures to expand domestic demand, and formulated a series of related policies. Together, they make up a systematic and comprehensive package plan aimed at promoting steady and relatively fast economic growth. Its main contents are as follows. First, substantially increase government spending to boost domestic demand. The Chinese government has announced a two-year investment program that will generate, through fiscal spending, a total investment of RMB 4 trillion yuan nationwide, equivalent to 16% of China's GDP in 2007. The money will mainly go into government-subsidized housing, projects related to the well-being of rural residents, the construction of railway and other infrastructural projects, social development programs, environmental protection, and post-earthquake recovery and reconstruction. The Chinese government has introduced a massive tax cut program, which will reduce the tax burdens on businesses and individuals by about 500 billion yuan each year. We have also cut interest rates by a large margin, increased liquidity in the banking system, and adopted a range of financial measures. Second, implement a large-scale industrial restructuring and rejuvenation program. We are pushing forward industrial restructuring and upgrading across the board and formulating plans for the restructuring and revitalization of 10 key industries, including automobiles and iron and steel. We will take economic and technological measures to boost energy conservation and reduce emissions, and promote merger and reorganization of enterprises to raise the level of industry concentration and the efficiency of resources allocation. We encourage and support the extensive application of new technologies, techniques, equipment, and materials at the development of marketable products by enterprises. Third, make energetic efforts for progress and innovation in science and technology. Science and technology are of fundamental importance in overcoming the financial crisis. A major crisis is usually followed by a revolution in science and technology. And no economic recovery is possible without technological innovation. We are stepping up the implementation of the National Program for Medium and Long-Term Scientific and Technological Development, with special emphasis on 16 major projects, including core electronic devices, development and use of nuclear energy, and advanced numerically controlled machine tools. We will strive to make breakthroughs in a host of core technologies and key generic technologies to support sustainable economic growth at a higher level. We will promote the development of high-tech industrial clusters and cultivate new economic growth areas. All in all, we will rely on major breakthroughs in science and technology to foster new social demand and bring about a new round of economic boom. Fourth, significantly raise the level of social security. We will continue to increase basic pension for enterprise retirees and upgrade the standard of unemployment insurance and workers' compensation. We will raise the level of basic cost of living allowances in both urban and rural areas and welfare allowances for those rural residents without family support. We are advancing the reform of the medical and health system and working to put in place a nationwide basic medical and health system covering both urban and rural areas within 3 years and achieve the goal of everyone having access to basic medical and health service. We give priority to education and are now working on the guidelines of the National Program for Medium and Long-Term Educational Reform and Development. We are following a more active employment policy with special emphasis on helping college graduates and migrant workers find jobs. We are endeavoring to create more jobs and lessen the impact of financial crisis on employment. The aforementioned measures will help us boost domestic demand, readjust and reinvigorate industries, enhance the support of science and technology, and strengthen social security. All at the same time, they will stimulate consumption through increased investment, drive economic growth while improving people's livelihood and creating more jobs, and see us through current difficulties while also improving the long-term prospect of the Chinese economy. They will not only benefit China's development, but also bring enormous business opportunities to other countries, Britain included. This once-in-a-century financial crisis is truly thought-provoking. It reminds us of the need to have serious reflections on the existing economic systems and theories. For many years in the past, China practiced a highly centralized planned economy and regarded planning as being absolute. This hampered the development of productivity. The ongoing financial crisis has made it clear to us, however, that the market is not a cure-all either. A totally laissez-faire approach will inevitably lead to economic disorder and unfair social distribution, and will eventually take its toll. A credible market-oriented reform should never set the market against government macro-regulation. The invisible hand of the market And the visible hand of government and social supervision should both act and should both act vigorously. Only in this way can resources be distributed according to market rules and distributed in a reasonable, coordinated, fair, and sustainable manner. The international financial crisis once again shows how dangerous a market economy without regulation can be. Since the 1990s, some profit-driven financial institutions in economies lacking effective regulation have raised massive capital with a leverage of dozens of times. While they reaped huge profits, the world was exposed to enormous risks. This fully demonstrates that a totally unregulated market economy cannot work. We must strike a balance between financial innovation and regulation, between the financial sector and real economy, and between savings and consumption. To effectively meet the crisis, we must fully recognize the role of morality. Nothing is greater than morality. It shines even more brightly than the sun. True economic theories will never come into conflict with the highest moral and ethical standards. Instead, they should stand for justice and integrity and contribute in an equal way to the well-being of all people, including the most vulnerable ones. Adam Smith, known as the father of modern economics, held the view in the theory of moral sentiments that if the fruits of a society's economic development cannot be shared by all, it is morally unsound and risky and unpopular, as it is bound to jeopardize social stability. The loss of morality is an underlying cause for the current crisis. Some people have sacrificed principle and sought profits at the expense of public interests. They have crossed the moral baseline. We should call on all enterprises to take up their social responsibilities. Within the body of every businessman should flow the blood of morality. Ladies and gentlemen, Britain is the last leg of my European trip. I have gained a deeper understanding of Europe through this visit. China-EU cooperation is now standing at a new historical starting point, and I am all the more confident about the China-EU comprehensive strategic partnership. There are no outstanding issues left over from history or conflict of fundamental interest between the two sides. What we have is a solid foundation and a bright future for cooperation. As the first industrialized country, Britain has accumulated rich experience in economic development and environmental protection. We hope to learn from your experience and strengthen exchanges and cooperation with you. The future belongs to the younger generation. It is incumbent upon you to build an even more splendid future of China-Britain relations. The progress of human society, the harmony of the world, are the trend of the times, are historical trend, and cannot be stopped. So let me finish my speech. Dr. Joseph Needham, in his monumental masterpiece, Science and Civilization in China, built a bridge between the two great civilizations of East and West to honor tradition and innovation is the outstanding character of Cambridge. I hope more of you will turn your eyes to China, see my country in the light of her development, and act as ambassadors of China-Britain friendship, so that this tradition will be handed down in Cambridge from generation to generation. I believe that as long as you, the young people of China and Britain, learn from each other and strive for progress hand in hand, you will add a brilliant new chapter to the annals of our relations. I thank you all.
You open up a landscape through the breadth and historic depths of your lecture this afternoon. I know that time is short. I know you will have opened up questions. And so let me turn things over to the Master of Gonville and Keys for the questions.
Prime Minister, thank you. I know that you have a plane to catch directly from here to Beijing. Time is very limited, so can I ask questioners to, firstly, to say who they are, secondly, to ask one question only, without any statements, and that way I think we may have time for two or three questions.
Premier Wen, thank you very much for your very interesting speech. My name is Christina Habel. I am reading for a Master in Philosophy in Development Studies, and we were lucky enough to learn a lot about China and its remarkable achievements in development. However, we have learned as well that development always comes with a price. And my question would be for you to comment on where you see that China has paid this price. Thank you.
China's development. 走过一条曲折的道路，在100多年以前，中国经济总量也曾经站在世界的前列，但是近代以来，中国落后了。 我觉得中国发展付出的代价最重要的，就是要经过艰苦的摸索，找到一条适合中国自己的发展道路。我们现在就是这样做的。我们进行的经济体制改革， 就是在解放和发展生产力。我们正在进行的政治体制改革，就是要实现 社会的公平正义和人的全面发展。我们在摸索中前进，可能还会走曲折的路，还会付出代价，但是我们已经认准了目标，我们一定能够取得胜利。谢谢。
About 100 years ago, China's economic aggregates were at the forefront of the world. Yet, entering into contemporary times, China started to fall behind. You asked about what price we paid for China's development. I would like to say that what we have been doing is to find a development path suited to China's own conditions through painstaking efforts.That's what we have been doing. Through economic restructuring, we want to release and develop productive forces in China. Through political restructuring, we want to achieve social justice and equity and provide every Chinese the opportunity to achieve all-round development. We will continue to make progress towards these ends through hard work. We may have some more detours.Or pay more price, but I believe we will continue to march forward as we have seen our goal very clearly now.
A question from the side. Yes, the gentleman with the glasses. Yes.
我是剑桥大学土地经济系的
Premier Wen, good afternoon.I'm studying at Cambridge University. My question for you is, from your point of view, in the current financial crisis, compared with the Asian financial crisis 10 years ago, is there any difference in terms of the position of China and what kind of role China can play differently? Thank you.
对中国的经济冲击是比较严重的。中国目前经济状况、金融状况比较良好，这是由于我们十年来对金融进行了改革，因此目前银行的资产规模、资产质量、不良贷款率、利润率货币流动性都比较好。这次金融危机对中国影响主要在实体经济，特别是外向经济、出口产业和劳动密集型产业。
The international financial crisis has inflicted a rather big impact on the Chinese economy. As far as the Chinese economy is concerned, our financial system remains in a good condition. That is attributable to the reform we have been undertaking in the financial sector of China, which started more than 10 years ago.Therefore, now the Chinese banks are in a fairly healthy condition in terms of the scale and quality of their assets, the NPL ratio, their profitability, and their liquidity. The impact of the financial crisis is mainly felt on the Chinese real economy, in particular for those export-driven sectors and labor-intensive industries.
应对这场金融危机必须实施正确的政策措施，最主要的就是大规模的财政投入以扩大内需。
To meet the international financial crisis, right policies and measures are vital. Most importantly, we must take massive government spending measure to boost domestic demand.
这种投入投向要准。速度要快，它的效果取决于规模和速度。
Such government spending must be made in a well-targeted and prompt way.
how effective it can be is dependent on how big the spending is and how fast it is taken.
我可以告诉大家，我们制定的十项政策措施都正在加以落实。
The 10 major policy measures we have formulated are all under implementation.
与此同时，我们要形成一个互相配套的、互相结合的完整的一揽子规划，兼顾当前和长远，标本兼治。
All our measures must make up a systematic and a comprehensive package plan. Its components should reinforce and support each other. Our aim is to focus on both the immediate, on the immediate difficulties and take into account long-term development to address both the symptoms and the root causes.
我们完全有信心，通过各项政策措施的落实，中国经济会有一个较大的改观。谢谢。
With the implementation of all these policy measures, we have full confidence that it will give a big boost to China's economic development.
'm sorry, I think we probably have to leave the questions there. Could I remind you, please, to remain in your seats to allow the Premier and his party to leave. Finally, I will invite the Vice-Chancellor formally to thank the Premier.
Premier Wen, thank you. Thank you. The great overarching scale of your lecture this afternoon and the great passage through time and through China's great growth in recent years, the challenges that China faces today, all this will stay with us as the interest of this afternoon. So will the questions and the seriousness of the questions and the answers and the many hands still raised, because there is a conversation to be continued and an exchange to be continued. And in the words of Xu Zhimo, we do hope that you will return. And finally, because the Premier really does have to be on his way on this dreadful afternoon, but we cannot let him go without a memento for you, Premier Wen, of this afternoon. And as many of you will know, we rang in the 800th year with bells pealing in Cambridge and around the world. And we have an engraved a bell for you, Premier Wen, as a symbol of Cambridge in its 800th year.